money that we had in one place was money that we had designated for higher education scholarship. And by the way, when I say higher education, this includes VOC, vocational opportunities, any number of things, right? But we are really proud of that. To add to what Rachel is saying, the difficulty of having all of the historical issues that people are aware of in native country and having no means of fixing it is unbearable for us, because all of the things, like I said, you imagine or know about from other Native communities are real in our situation. And yet, what I would say is, as an elected leader, one of the worst things about this work is those late night calls, a family in crisis, a person who doesn't have a home, or somebody struggling with suicide, whatever it is. And all we have to offer is our own physical selves, right? The energy that we can muster within our household, or that, like, just my physically going to be present with somebody.
Thank you guys again for being with us.
Ayumasi.
Ayumasi.
That was Chinook.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
Tune in at 7 a.m. Monday through Friday for Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM.
It's a political moment and environment that's not conducive to advancing the rights of LGBTQI persons at the international stage.
A decision by council member to renew this mandate would send a clear message that violence and discrimination against people of diverse sexual orientation and gender identity cannot be tolerated.
The resolution doesn't create any rights, just basically the continuation of the work of the independent expert.
Visibility is power, and our power is exactly what they fear.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Brian DeShazer. 50 are arrested in Istanbul for attempted pride. China's war on gay male erotica continues, and the UN Human Rights Council votes on an independent queer expert. Those stories and more this week, because you've chosen This Way Out.
I'm Ava Davis.
And I'm John Dyer V.
With a news wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending July 5th, 2025. Activists attempted pride in Istanbul on June 29th, and as many as 50-plus were arrested for it. That's been the annual exercise since Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan banned pride events in 2015, a year after he took power. Riot gear-clad police blocked the streets to confront the LGBTQ protesters and their allies trying to march. Police chased down and captured several people in the city center for simply carrying rainbow flags, according to some accounts. Erdogan's anti-queer behavior has only gotten worse over the last decade. He regularly calls LGBTQ people perverts. When he declared 2025 to be the year of the family, he insisted that the very existence of queer people undermines traditional family values. Governor of Istanbul, Davut Gül, is marching too, in lockstep with Erdogan. To Gül, what was once one of the region's largest peaceful pride gatherings undermines social peace, family structure, and moral values. He declared, "No gathering or march that threatens public order will be tolerated." same-gender sex is not specifically illegal in Turkey. However, strong societal taboos in a Muslim-majority country prevent sexual and gender minorities from gaining any meaningful civil rights protections. Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch have each charged that the rhetoric and actions by Erdogan and his subservient government officials virtually endorse discrimination and violence against LGBTQ people. Meanwhile, queer European advocates are still buzzing about Budapest's Pride Parade the previous day. An estimated 200,000 people defied a similar ban in authoritarian Prime Minister Viktor Orbán's Hungary.
In China, at least 30 more women were detained during an apparent second wave in the continuing crackdown on gay male erotica, known as Danmei, or Boy's Love. Dozens of women were arrested earlier this year for writing and posting on the Taiwan-based adult fiction site Haitang Literature City. The stories, penned mostly by women in their 20s, are popular with young female readers seeking to challenge traditional gender roles. To Chinese authorities, it's considered obscene content. Two lawyers representing some of the detainees told the New York Times that as many as 50 writers may have been arrested during the past few weeks. The Haitang Literature website allows some writers to earn modest tips from readers, and Chinese authorities tend to particularly target them for arrest. Punishment often depends on whether writers can repay the money they earned. Some of the site's top authors have received varying sentences of 1 to 5 years in prison. Homosexuality was decriminalized in China in 1997 and declassified as a mental disorder in 2001. However, the government has continued to deny LGBTQ people basic civil rights and to suppress positive cultural representations of sexual and gender minorities.
President Donald Trump signed the controversial budget reconciliation bill into law on U.S. Independence Day, July 4th. Republican majorities in both houses of the U.S. Congress complied with their party leaders' wishes despite the opposition of most of the country's people. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office concluded that what Trump called his Big Beautiful Bill gives huge tax breaks to millionaires and billionaires on the backs of people who access government-sponsored Medicaid healthcare and the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, known as SNAP. The Williams Institute at the UCLA School of Law says that close to 13% of LGBTQ adults in the country rely on Medicaid as their primary health insurance provider. That's about 1.8 million people. Many of them will be among the estimated 10 million who will now lose their coverage. The only silver lining was that the Senate parliamentarian determined that blocking the use of federal funding to reimburse medical care for transgender young people could not be a part of the bill under the chamber's legislative rules. The Williams Institute finds that women and transgender people will be the most affected by cuts to SNAP. The think tank that focuses on public policies impacting LGBTQ people says some 250,000 trans individuals and 1.3 million lesbian and bisexual women were able to access SNAP in the past year. An estimated 7 million people in the U.S. will now either lose SNAP benefits entirely or see their benefit amounts severely reduced. The law also substantially increases funding for the Defense Department and for Homeland Security, which includes ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement. That will put even more of the often masked and unidentified military-style officers on the streets of U.S. cities to detain and disappear people based on little more than racial profiling.
The U.S. Supreme Court capped its 2024-2025 session this week by threatening the rights of transgender people in four more states. justices told the appeals courts with jurisdictions in Idaho, North Carolina, Oklahoma, and West Virginia to reconsider rulings in support of trans rights. Their directives follow last week's Scrimeti decision to uphold Tennessee's ban on pediatric gender-affirming health care. The High Court said that the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit needs to reconsider its ruling against an Idaho ban on gender-affirming health care for minors. The justices already ruled last year that the state could continue enforcing the law even after that appellate court ruled against it. Following suit, the Supreme Court majority ordered the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals to review its decisions that neither North Carolina nor West Virginia could deny coverage for gender-affirming health care to all transgender individuals. Justices also told the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Tenth Circuit to reconsider a decision blocking Oklahoma's law barring transgender people from changing gender markers on birth certificates and other official government documents. Announcements on these cases had been postponed pending their ruling in the Tennessee trans health care case.
Looking ahead to the next U.S. Supreme Court session, bans on transgender young people participating in school sports programs will be on the docket. Justices announced on July 3rd that they'll hear two cases filed by trans students, their families, and advocates challenging laws that ban their participation. Idaho's restrictions require intrusive gender testing to determine a female competitor's eligibility. In the other case, a transgender middle school athlete is challenging West Virginia's ban on trans competitors. Rulings from the High Court are expected to be announced in June 2026. There are similar bans in more than half of the 50 U.S. states. Republican majorities in both the U.S. House of Representatives and Senate have thus far unsuccessfully tried to pass similar laws at the federal level.
Finally, Australia's national men's field hockey team took to the pitch wearing rainbow socks to support a gay teammate during Pride Month. Midfielder Davis Atkin was outed to his coach at the University of Canberra by a team psychologist in 2021. Atkin told the queer athletics site OutSports that the incident put him in a pretty dark place. Atkin has now played for the Australian National Kookaburras team close to 20 times. A photo of the team posted on Instagram depicted all of them wearing rainbow socks. The multi-hued hosiery-wearing Kookaburras overcame a two-goal deficit in late June to defeat England during an International Hockey Federation Pro League tournament in London by the score of 4-3. Atkin posted a photo on social media with a pride flag draped around his shoulders, captioned, "Being able to run out onto the pitch with pride socks together as a team was something truly special. The inclusivity, the support, and the joy in this group made it all feel surreal. You can't be what you can't see, and even something as simple as rainbow socks can be a powerful sign to someone out there that they are seen, valid, and belong."
That's NewsWrap, global queer news with attitude, for the week ending July 5th, 2025. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap is written by Greg Gordon and Lucia Chappelle, produced by Brian DeShazer, and brought to you by you.
Thank you. Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more. For This Way Out, I'm Ava Davis. Stay healthy.
And I'm John Dyer V. Stay safe.
Our listeners support This Way Out in many ways.
By subscribing to our e-newsletter.
Email us at info@thiswayout.org.
And through your financial contributions to our program.
More information about how you can give is online at thiswayout.org.
Thank you.
You just call on me, brother.
The
global struggle to secure human rights of LGBTQ people has a powerful advocate at the United Nations, but will that always be so? That advocate's voice was nearly silenced this week when the time came for the United Nations Human Rights Council to renew its mandate. This Way Out's David Hunt talks with a human rights activist who is anxiously monitoring the vote.
You might expect human rights to merit unequivocal support at the United Nations, especially at the UN Human Rights Council, based in Geneva, Switzerland, where 47 member countries hotly debate efforts to promote and protect human rights around the globe. In reality, majorities are often thin, with a surprising number of nations sustaining or even voting no on resolutions advancing human rights. In October 2024, for example, fewer than half, just 23 nations, endorsed a one-year extension of an international fact-finding mission to Sudan, where a civil war has created an ongoing, dire humanitarian and human rights crisis. 12 nations, including China and Indonesia, voted against the resolution, and 12 others abstained. If there's a strong consensus to be found of late, it's on the margins of the UN, among a broad coalition of nonprofit agencies, urging the Human Rights Council to extend the mandate of an independent expert committed to protecting LGBTQ people from violence and discrimination. The vote on the mandate's three-year renewal is expected to be close. I'm David Hunt. For all its work as a peacekeeping body, the United Nations has something in common with military organizations, a love of acronyms. In this program, I'll try to keep them to a minimum, but one acronym you'll hear over and over is IESOGI. IE is short for Independent Expert. SOGI, S-O-G-I, is short for Sexual Orientation and Gender Identity. At the UN, IESOGI is a man, South African scholar Graham Reed, and a mandate, a position created under the UN's Special Procedures Mechanism to ensure, monitor, advise, and publicly report on matters related to human rights violations based on sexual orientation and gender identity. The Council created the three-year position in 2016 and renewed it twice, in 2019 and again in 2021. This week's vote, to renew the mandate for another 3 years, comes at a fraught time for the global LGBTQ movement. Fabiana Label is a program manager at the International Service for Human Rights in Geneva, an organization that supports human rights defenders around the world through training, activism, research, and legal advice. ISHR works on the front lines in some of the world's most challenging areas, promoting rights and accountability in autocratic nations, strengthening laws and systems in struggling democracies, and supporting human rights activists in regions enduring war, violence, and targeted oppression. Label has a front-row seat to this week's pivotal vote at the UN Human Rights Council. She spoke with me from the Council's headquarters in the Palace of Nations, a sprawling complex overlooking Lake Geneva, built to house the League of Nations after the First World War. I asked her about the upcoming vote to renew IESOGI and why some members of the Human Rights Council are expected to oppose the resolution.
This time around, we have what we call a technical rollover, which is basically a very short resolution that just states what the mandate is and then asks for the renewal. One of the main objections has always been that it's a myth at the same time that this is a mandate that's driven by what they call Western values, despite it being a resolution that's presented by seven Latin American countries. There are a number of grounds on which this is objected, from kind of religious claims around religious practices, claims around cultural norms and family values, which are absolutely not in conformity with UN human rights standards. There are many different claims, but they come from a place of intolerance and a place of discrimination against sexual orientation and diverse sexual orientation and gender identities.
Do you expect this to be a close vote?
Yes. Yes, yes. It's a political moment and environment that's not conducive to advancing the rights of LGBTQI persons at the international stage. Like, what we want is to secure that this mandate continue its very important and key work, because the resolution doesn't create any rights, doesn't propose any new language. It's basically the continuation of the work of the independent expert. We expect a close vote, yes. And also, beside the votes, there's also the attempts to weaken the text, attempts to make the empty the resolution of meaning and relevance. So, yes.
To counter this opposition, a coalition of more than 1,200 NGOs, non-governmental organizations, signed a statement of support for the renewal of IE Soji. Trans activist Best Chitsanjupong read the statement at a meeting of the Human Rights Council in late June.
In every region of the world, violence and discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity persists. In 2016, the UN Human Rights Council took definitive action to systemically address this abuse, creating independent expert on SOGI. Since then, mandate holders have sent over 171 communications documenting allegations of violations and carried out 10 country visits. A decision by council member to renew this mandate would send a clear message that violence and discrimination against people of diverse sexual orientation and gender identity cannot be tolerated. It would reaffirm that specific attention continues to be crucial to address this human rights violation and ensure that LGBT people are in fact free and equal in dignity and rights. We urge the council to ensure we continue building a world where everyone can live free from violence and discrimination. I thank you.
In time, you know, everything we've lost comes home again, and I will grab onto your arm a little stronger than we were before.
You're listening to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm David Hunt. IE Soji, the United Nations independent expert on violence and discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity, has worked since 2016 to advance the human rights of LGBTQ people around the globe. It's critical work in an increasingly fractured world. 64 countries still outlaw same-sex sexual activity, and 10 criminalize diverse gender expression and identities. But efforts to secure the human rights of LGBTQ people have improved in some countries in the past decade. Since the IE Soji mandate was established in 2016, 14 countries have decriminalized gay sex. The United Kingdom, responsible for colonial-era anti-sodomy laws around the world, apologized to Commonwealth leaders in 2018, urging repeal of those laws. Fabiana Label, a program manager for ISHR, the International Service for Human Rights, says the independent expert's work is needed now more than ever.
I think the ISOG's mandate is crucial because it deals with issues that perhaps couldn't be dealt with at the national level. Another fundamental aspect of the mandate is the mandate's ability to comment on policy and legislation, and particularly question governments when laws and legislation are violating the rights of people in general. And I think the ISOG has also done an incredible job in addressing those situations and commenting on legislation and submitting information and asking for clarification. And this is another aspect of the mandate, which is really important. The fact that the mandate has visited so many countries also is, the visit itself provides a platform for civil society organizations. The recommendations that come out of those visits are a great tool for civil society organizations to work on, to follow up on, to keep, you know, pushing their governments.
The coalition of NGOs campaigning for renewal of the mandate is active on social media, where the hashtag #RenewIESOGI is used to publicize informational webinars and online petitions. I sat in on one of those webinars hosted by the Carr Ryan Center for Human Rights at the Harvard Kennedy School last week. Jessica Stern, a Carr Ryan Senior Fellow and formerly the State Department's top envoy for LGBTQ rights, recalled the hard-fought effort to create the IESOGI mandate in 2016.
We started with joint statements, voluntary ones, to test whether any government would even dare to say our names in the halls of power. Then we secured the first resolution at the Human Rights Council, recognizing violence and discrimination based on SOGI. I will never forget it, what it was like to be in the room that day, watching a third of the room walk out in protest during the first panel. And then watching them reappear moments later on the mezzanine, watching from above because they couldn't stay away. That moment made something clear. Visibility is power, and our power is exactly what they feared.
Another featured speaker, scholar and activist Ignacio Saiz, summarized some of his findings from a 2024 report on IESOGI.
The mandate has significantly expanded the body of knowledge on violence and discrimination based on SOGI. What so many people have valued is how it's looked not just at specific forms of abuse, you know, like conversion therapy or denial of gender recognition. It's looked at the root causes. And that's quite unusual for a UN human rights body. So it's really shone a spotlight on patriarchal gender constructs, legacies of colonialism, religious fundamentalisms, and how religion is politically manipulated for certain ends. And that systemic analysis, that systematic analysis, has enabled it to take on some of the deeper cultural narratives that pathologize, that demonize, and that criminalize queer lives.
Back in Geneva, Fabiana Label awaits the vote at the Human Rights Council with grim determination.
It's hard to be optimistic at this point in time, particularly because what we've seen are challenges to multilateralism. That is what we're seeing. It's not only about the UN, it's about norms, standards, guarantees at the international level that are, you know, are being disregarded. So it's hard to be optimistic when the whole system is not responding the way we would have expected to respond, and that states are actively working against it.
A victory at the UN for IESOGI would be welcome news for human rights activists around the world, a spark of hope in challenging times. I'd like to thank Fabiana Label at the International Service for Human Rights for speaking with me for this program, and the Carr Ryan Center at Harvard for its public education efforts. For This Way Out, I'm David Hunt.
The air is clear with our loved ones close. You can pick out every star without a telescope. So beautiful to see how we have changed. In time, you know, everything we've lost comes on again. And I will grab onto your arm a little stronger than we were before.
This just in. The Human Rights Council renewed the mandate of the Independent Expert on Sexual Orientation and Gender Identity on July 7th. There were 29 votes in favor of adopting the resolution, with 15 voting against and 3 abstentions. Thanks for choosing This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. News Wrap was reported this week by Ava Davis and John Dyer V, and produced by Brian DeShazer. Our correspondent was David Hunt. Kansas, Bill Withers, Foster, and Michael Shines performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley, and all the listener donors who make this program possible. Ask us about how you can join them. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email us at info@thiswayout.org, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon, associate producer Lucia Chappell, and the entire This Way Out crew, I'm Brian DeShazer. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org or wherever you get your podcasts, and on KCMJ Colorado Springs, Colorado, WGGT Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 4NSA Nooseheads, Queensland, and a wide array of community terrestrial and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay healthy, stay safe, and stay tuned.
I am Dr. Demento. I am here in a land of happy, freaky people. KBOO Portland.
Do you need some quiet mood music? Some soothing sounds?
Well, then never listen to Life During Wartime, because they just play really obnoxious DIY punk from local bands and international acts. Sometimes they have bands play live, and it's all with the yelling and the screaming and the I don't like my mom and dad or my teachers and all that kind of stuff. That's Life During Wartime, every other Wednesday from 10 to midnight, here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
The school has been, for many decades now, developing curriculum on effective advocacy, policy, and it didn't have a focus on LGBTQ rights or the global LGBTQ landscape. And it was ripe for that. How can we look at the existing community organizing and leadership work and tailor that for activists around the world so that they have access to it without having to pay $100,000 a year at Harvard?
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Brian DeShazer. Hong Kong's government teases limited queer spousal rights. Pope Leo echoes the same gender couple blessing policy of Francis. And Harvard's global LGBTQI plus rights initiative faces Trump shutdown threats. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Marcos Najera.
And I'm Natalie Munoz.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending July 12, 2025. Same-gender couples in Hong Kong who have legal recognition from abroad could get health-related spousal rights under a new government proposal. The document specifically states that it is not equivalent to civil marriage rights. It is an effort by lawmakers to satisfy a landmark 2023 ruling by Hong Kong's Court of Final Appeal that ordered legal recognition for queer couples who have civil unions or marriages from foreign countries. One of the spouses must be a Hong Kong resident. The rights in the proposal are limited to mutual medical decision-making and the right to claim the deceased spouse's body and to decide if the remains can be used for medical education or research. The measure is far from a done deal, according to the South China Morning Post, however. So far, at least 41 of the 89-member Legislative Council have indicated their objection to the proposal. They include members from the Democratic Alliance for the Betterment and Progress of Hong Kong, the Business and Professionals Alliance, the Federation of Trade Unions, and the Liberal Party. Legislator Regina Ip Lau Suk Yi says that she and five other members of her New People's Party will support the proposal. She's the convener of the Key Decision-Making Executive Council.
Queer advocates suggest that the measure should be postponed in the council so that public hearings and other consultations can allow time to develop sufficient legislative support for the proposal. Of course, Hong Kong officials can only push the envelope so far, considering mainland China's steadfast disapproval when it comes to queer issues. Even if it's a stretch, the proposal may not fully satisfy the Court of Appeal ruling. Pro-democracy and human rights activist Jimmy Sham fought a 5-year legal battle to get that victory. As he told the Associated Press, "I hope the government will listen to opinions from society and the community and try to develop a solution that doesn't exceed society's acceptance level, while meeting the expectations of same-sex couples and avoiding legal challenges."
Pope Leo XIV is expected to maintain his predecessor's policy of allowing priests to bless same-gender couples. Cardinal Victor Manuel Fernandez of the Vatican's Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith was asked by a local reporter on July 3rd if Leo would reverse Pope Francis's position. Fernandez replied, "I don't think so. The declaration will remain," according to the National Catholic Reporter. That's not considered to be an official church statement. Pope Leo has told the Vatican Diplomatic Corps that he also reaffirms the Roman Catholic Church's refusal to hold ceremonies to recognize the marriages of same-gender couples. In his words, "Family is still founded upon the stable union between a man and a woman." That's also consistent with policies expressed by Pope Francis. As Cardinal Robert Prevost, Leo had a somewhat limited but mixed record on LGBTQ rights.
More than 100 transgender inmates in Tehran's infamous Evin prison are missing and presumed dead following Israeli airstrikes on June 23rd. Authorities in the Iranian capital confirmed that they were housed in the hardest-hit area of the prison. Officially, 79 people are known dead and dozens more injured. The casualties included guards, administrative staff, healthcare and social workers, a lawyer, visiting relatives, and nearby residents, including a 5-year-old child. Being transgender itself can be a criminal offense in Iran. Trans people can only be legally recognized after undergoing gender affirmation surgery. In many cases, they're considered mentally ill. There are no legal protections from hate crimes or discrimination. Evin prison is the main facility for the Islamic Republic's political prisoners, problematic reporters and educators, and foreigners accused of spying. It has a documented history of deplorable living conditions and human rights abuses such as beatings, torture, sleep deprivation, sexual assault, and lengthy solitary confinement. The bombing that killed the transgender inmates was described as a symbolic act of liberation by Israeli Foreign Minister Gideon Saar, according to the New York Times.
North Carolina Governor Josh Stein vetoed bills this week targeting the rights of transgender people and programs promoting diversity, equity, and inclusion. The bills targeted DEI policies at public universities and community colleges, secondary schools, and state and local government agencies. They also gave parents greater rights to challenge the availability of school library books. Democrat Stein called the Republican-backed measures mean-spirited. The transgender bill began as a bipartisan measure to curb sexual exploitation by enforcing age verification and consent rules for pornography websites. Lawmakers later added a ban on state-funded gender-affirming procedures for prisoners, followed by a provision affirming the recognition of only two genders. Stein said in his veto message that he strongly supported the original anti-sexual exploitation provisions in the bill, but that the final measure was a different story. Bucking the Trump administration and Republican state lawmakers, Stein wrote, "At a time when teachers, law enforcement, and state employees need pay raises and people need shorter lines at the DMV, the legislature failed to pass a budget and instead wants to distract us by stoking culture wars that further divide us. I stand ready to work with the legislature when it gets serious about protecting people and addressing North Carolinians' pressing concerns."
Wisconsin Supreme Court has narrowly voted to affirm the state's ban on conversion therapy. The 4-3 ruling decided that a Republican-dominated legislative committee had violated the state constitution by refusing to enforce an agency's rule that implemented the ban. Democratic Governor Tony Evers issued an executive order in 2021 that prohibited government funds from being used for conversion therapy, that much-debunked practice that aims to change sexual orientation or gender identity through psychological counseling and/or prayer. He filed suit against the state legislature in 2023 for obstructing basic government functions when the committee had previously tried to derail the ban. The High Court sided with Evers in its July 8th ruling, deciding that a legislative committee cannot block the implementation of an agency rule without the passage of specific legislation. Elections do have consequences. The Wisconsin Supreme Court's liberal majority survived a high-profile campaign in April that defeated multi-billionaire Elon Musk's outrageously expensive effort to install a Trump-supported jurist.
Finally, first the Trump administration came for transgender people. Now they're erasing bisexuals. All references to trans people were ordered removed from the Stonewall National Monument website in February. Now the same fate seems to have befallen bi folk. Earlier incarnations of the National Park Service hosted website highlighted what it called LGBTQ+ activism. That acronym was replaced by LGB. And now there were presumably only lesbian and gay people at the historic Stonewall riots of June 1969. 8 references to bisexuals on the site as of April of this year have been reduced to only 2, according to reports. Trans journalist Aaron Reed compared the original Stonewall National Monument website with the current one. She found that it was, before the 1960s, almost everything about living openly as a lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, or queer LGBTQ+ person was illegal. Now it's, before the 1960s, almost everything about living authentically as a gay or lesbian person was illegal. The Stonewall National Monument was created in 2016 by President Barack Obama as the first such site dedicated to the advancement of LGBTQ rights. Tanya Azapanza Johnson-Walker reminded a crowd at the monument's physical site in New York City that queer people have been here since the beginning of time, according to Pink News. The trans activist told those protesting the disappearance of the full spectrum of the queer community, "We're here to stay, and we will not be erased by a Christo-fascist neo-Nazi administration."
That's News Wrap. Global Queer News with Attitude for the week ending July 12, 2025. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon and Lucia Chappell, produced by Brian DeShazer, and brought to you by you.
Thank you. Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more. For This Way Out, I'm Marcos Najera. Stay healthy.
And I'm Natalie Munoz. Stay safe.
City of Night. City of Night. Woo!
Hello, I'm John Ritchie, author of City of Night, and you're listening to This Way Out, the international gay and lesbian radio magazine. I hope that you do stay tuned.
Our listeners support This Way Out in many ways.
By subscribing to our e-newsletter.
Email us at info@thiswayout.org.
And through your financial contributions to our program.
More information about how you can give is online at thiswayout.org.
Thank you.
Fight, demonstrate to them our skill. Albeit they possess the might, nonetheless we have the will.
Will Harvard University have the will to fend off threats from the Trump administration to cut off federal research dollars and bar international students from enrolling? It's not just one school. It's a wide-ranging assault on higher education designed to break the commitment to diversity, equity, and inclusion. Meanwhile, Harvard's John F. Kennedy School of Government is breaking new ground in its efforts to advance LGBTQ liberation in the U.S. and around the globe. The acclaimed public policy school's long-established Carr Ryan Center for Human Rights houses the global LGBTQI+ human rights program. That year-old program director is Diego Garcia Bloom. As Bloom tells This Way Out's David Hunt, the program has already done much to expand queer social research and to promote international activism through the power of storytelling.
Harvard University, the renowned Ivy League school on the banks of the Charles River outside of Boston, has dominated higher education in the United States for nearly 400 years, since its founding in 1636. Among its alumni, Harvard boasts 8 U.S. presidents, over 150 Nobel laureates, 46 Olympic gold medalists, and 10 Academy Award winners. But it's only in the last 150 years or so that the college has been what American conservatives would call woke. The university reformed its curriculum in the late 19th century, moving away from its Puritan roots, introducing more elective courses and emphasizing scientific and modern subjects. The first black student earned a degree in 1870. Women were officially admitted as students during the Second World War. And the first openly gay professor came out in 1982. Another milestone in the school's long history of social progress came just a year ago, in May 2024, when the Carr Ryan Center for Human Rights, a think tank in the Harvard Kennedy School, launched the Global LGBTQI+ Human Rights Program. While Harvard battles the Trump administration in court to protect diversity, equity, and inclusion programs on campus, the Carr Ryan Center has kept its eyes on the prize, focusing on training and leadership development, research, public engagement, and partnerships, all aligned to advance the human rights of LGBTQ people, especially in parts of the world where those rights are threatened, disappearing, or non-existent. I'm David Hunt. I sat down with Diego Garcia Bloom, director of the Global LGBTQI+ Human Rights Program at the Carr Ryan Center, to discuss the program's accomplishments over its first year. The goal, he told me, is to empower this and the next generation of LGBTQ activists, to give them the benefits of a Harvard education without the sticker shock of Harvard tuition.
The school has been, for many decades now, developing curriculum on effective advocacy, policy, and it didn't have a focus on LGBTQ rights or the global LGBTQ landscape, and it was ripe for that. We had professors who had been working in the intersection of all the international bodies, including the UN, the Association of American States, all of the international bodies where LGBTQ activists were working, but no specific focus on LGBTQ work. And then also we had so much incredible content on advocacy and community organizing, which is the core and the root of how this work gets done around the world, that when I came to Harvard as a student, realized activists all over the world would benefit so, so much from being able to have access to this. And so I came in really trying to understand a couple of things as a student, actually. First, what can we learn from a research standpoint of where change has happened before and make frameworks, lessons, academic work out of that so that other activists don't have to reinvent the wheel every time, but rather have the takeaways from that work. And second, how can we look at the existing community organizing and leadership work and tailor that for activists around the world so that they have access to it without having to pay $100,000 a year at Harvard? And so that was the premise of the program. We brought together incredible faculty at the university to say, would you be willing to work with us to make this accessible to activists all over the world where they are? And they said yes. And we have over 33 affiliated faculty from all over the university that come together for our training programs now that have now over 80 participants in the year that we've been running and also in the pilot that we did before this.
In addition to this intensive six-month advocacy and leadership program, the Carr Ryan Center has its online Changemakers Network, a global community of 2,000 LGBTQ activists who participate in regular virtual training sessions on a wide range of topics.
When we were looking at what we could offer, we knew the really impactful kind of learning is being able to be in a space where you hear from others, where you're able to constantly interact with activists around the world. And so we wanted to create a community of learning where we could offer around twice or three times a month workshops that people could come together and around a specific topic, learn and share. And so we created the Global LGBTQI Plus Changemakers Network. And this really is a community of learning where we, on a very constant basis, trainings and informational content that people come together to learn. But also not only that, it goes beyond just the learning too. When we need some kind of research, interview some folks around the world for research, or maybe even if they have internships and we have some money for some Harvard students to intern somewhere. And so it's a community of folks working in the space that we rely on for research, for trainings, for learning for our students. And so it's around now 2,000 activists in 170 countries.
The Carr Ryan Center has a big online presence, producing podcasts, webinars, and virtual training programs attended by hundreds, sometimes thousands, of people. But it also believes in the effectiveness of face-to-face learning and discovery. Its International LGBTQI Plus Activism Summit, held on campus in October 2024, brought together activists from 20 countries for an immersive learning experience. Participants worked with Harvard faculty to explore proven strategies for countering the myths used to oppress and stigmatize LGBTQ people around the world. When I spoke with him, Bloom had just returned from a trip to South America, where he conducted face-to-face training programs for scores of activists who hadn't been able to attend the summit in the United States. It was a chance for people on the front lines of social change to network and learn from Harvard research and from each other.
I was just in Rio, and one of the things that we did was we brought together leaders after an event. And one of the things that shocked me a little bit was the convening I did on my trip there was the first time many of these local leaders were meeting for the first time. And these were not only local, but people working in this space for a long time internationally at the UN. And they're like, yeah, we don't have many opportunities or forums to come together to discuss the work or our stories. And so one of the benefits and kind of the value added that our program has is being able to say, hey, let's bring the leaders together that are working in this space, but usually not interacting with each other. And let's convene, know each other. The social is just as important as movement and social movement. And in sharing our stories, we create also these new pathways to collaboration between them.
You were listening to This Way Out, the International LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm David Hunt, continuing my conversation with Diego Garcia Bloom, Director of the Global LGBTQI Plus Human Rights Program at the Carr Ryan Center at Harvard. Bloom explained the leadership framework underlying much of the program's work, a framework based on the power of storytelling.
One of the main trainings that we lean on from the Kennedy School is Marshall Ganz's public narrative and community organizing work. And a big foundation in Colombia invited us to get activists together to go over this training. I'll tell you the beauty of this training is it's about sharing our stories. And so the idea is that there is a three-part framework on how do we get people to have shared values into action. It's not enough that you may have a ton of people that believe in equality for LGBTQ people. That's not enough to get people into action. There is a leadership practice, and we call it public narrative, to be able to move people into action. And so that goes into three parts. It's the story of self. The story of self is, why am I here? Why am I doing this work? And it's important to give people that story to be able to root your leadership. The story of us is, what brings us together? What are our shared values, and what are our challenges that we're facing together? And the story of now is, and what are we going to do together now? And it's a practice that we teach in workshops. And so, for example, I go when I do this work and I say, you know, I grew up as a gay immigrant in the United States, bullied in school in an evangelical church that tried to put deep, deep shame in me. The bullying I experienced in school when I was in recess and the kids would call me names, would send me to cry to the bathroom. And I had that deep shame that I lived with for so long that characterized my upbringing. And it led me to a deep depression as an adolescent. And the reason why I do this work is because I do not want kids to go through that again. And so, for example, when I tell my story, people understand, I know why he does this work. He lived through that experience, and this is what motivates me. So we ask folks, why are you here? And sometimes they haven't even articulated that. And they say, one of the participants in one of the trainings that I did recently said, one day I had a homophobic neighbor who one day just came up to me and hit me. And then we start going through the stories that move people into action. And that's where you get people's, their anchor. And then we say, you know, we've all experienced something like that, you know? And so the challenge that we have now is, how do we make a better world? And so that is the story of us. The story of us is, I come with my experiences, you come with yours, but we have a shared challenge now. And then the story of now is, well, we have work to do. And what does it look like right now? And how do we move together into action?
In all its work with activists around the world, the Global LGBTQI+ Human Rights Program is committed to translating cutting-edge research into real-world action. The program supports 9 LGBTQ research fellows working in areas such as feminist theory, organizational development, the rise of authoritarianism, and the global anti-gender movement. I asked Bloom about the challenges of working in higher education, and particularly at Harvard, in the face of ongoing threats from the Trump administration.
Harvard is under attack. There are folks who see this work that we're doing and also the other programs around Harvard and want to change that and how we teach, who teaches it, and trying to stifle that academic freedom. So I'm just very grateful that the university took a stand to be able to teach what it wants, to be able to have academic freedom while being very strong under anti-Semitism task forces and work, because as we can see there's been kind of this entryway of using anti-Semitism as a way to attack everything in the university, including LGBTQ work, including racial justice work, including all this academic work revolving around this. And so it's a fraught time. It should raise alarm bells everywhere. I would say, you know, everyone stand with Harvard. Stand with Harvard.
Last week, Harvard rebranded its student DEI office, renaming it the Office of Culture and Community. And it took down, at least for now, websites for its Women's Center, LGBTQ Student Life, and Intercultural Affairs. Are these the first steps toward a settlement with the Trump administration? Or is the university standing down in the face of White House pressure? Time will tell. I'd like to thank Diego Garcia Bloom at Harvard's Carr Ryan Center for Human Rights for speaking with me for this program. For This Way Out, I'm David Hunt.
Thanks for discovering This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. News Wrap was reported this week by Marcos Najera and Natalie Munoz, and produced by Brian DeShazer. Our correspondent was David Hunt. Crosby, Stills and Nash, Tom Lehrer, and Logan Pilcher performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks Hal Myers of Santa Fe, New Mexico, Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley, and all the listener donors who make this program possible. Ask us about how you can join them. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email us at info@thiswayout.org, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon, associate producer Lucia Chappell, and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Brian DeShazer. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And on WADR, Janesville, Wisconsin, CFMH, St. John, New Brunswick, KSXU, Seattle, Washington, and a wide array of community terrestrial and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay healthy, stay safe, and stay tuned.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
Hello, I'm Eugene Rashad. Join me every Saturday from 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. for the best in jazz on your community radio station, KBOO 90.7 on your FM dot.
But I dig, and I know